Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is on assignment. On the NewsHour tonight, ceasefire. Gazans start returning to their shattered homes, and Israeli forces start pulling back as part of the tenuous deal to end the war. The Trump administration begins mass layoffs during the government shutdown. We speak with House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries about Democrats' response.
This is just a continuation of the chaos, the crisis, and the confusion that we've seen during the entirety of the Trump administration. We're going to continue to stay the course as Democrats.
And actors Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter reunite, this time on stage.
It is a play about two old friends who are interested in interrogating the questions of life, which is very much the two of us.
Welcome to the NewsHour. For the first time in more than 6 months, the guns have gone silent in Gaza. And Palestinians and Israelis are saying tonight they hope this ceasefire will prove to be the end of the war. Israeli troops repositioned inside Gaza and are preparing for Hamas to release the Israeli hostages promised for early next week. And as Nick Schifrin reports, Palestinians use the respite from relentless bombing to start picking up the pieces.
On Gaza's coastal road today, it's time to go home, even if their destination is beyond recognition. Tens of thousands, all displaced multiple times for 2 years, headed north to Gaza City as the ceasefire took effect.
God willing, this will be the last war we see. There's nothing left of us.
They walked, rolled, were pulled, traveled by any means necessary, hoping they were driving toward peace.
Praise be to God. I'm very happy to have returned to my land and my home, even though it's been bombed and destroyed.
Not just homes have been destroyed, entire neighborhoods, in some cases, entire cities. What used to be a residential street in Khan Yunis, now just rubble.
The situation is tragic. There are no houses, there are no streets, no cars are able to enter. For those who are going back, what are they supposed to find? There is nothing. There is no life. But it's better if they build a tent on the ruins than stay away from their land.
The Israel Defense Forces says it's completed its withdrawal to the yellow line shown here. They'll still control 53% of the Gaza Strip. The tanks that had threatened to help seize Gaza City withdrew, but the military warned Gazans not to approach Israeli soldiers and claim victory over Hamas.
Hamas today is not the Hamas of 2 years ago. Hamas has been defeated everywhere we fought them. We are in a completely different place now. The IDF is deployed deep inside the Gaza Strip.
But as of now, Hamas has not agreed to demilitarize. That challenge has been left to the negotiations phase two. And if Hamas refuses, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today threatened more war.
If this can be achieved the easy way, very well. If not, it will be achieved the hard way.
And now that the Israelis have moved to that yellow line, the 72-hour countdown has begun for Hamas to release all the Israeli hostages, 48 in total, 20 believed to be alive, now scheduled, Jeff, for Monday.
And Nick, you've been speaking today with U.S. officials about how the U.S. military will help guarantee this ceasefire. What have you learned?
Yeah, so a U.S. official provides more details of what we first reported last night from senior administration officials. 200 personnel from the military's central command, CENTCOM, will arrive by Sunday to create the Civil Military Coordination Center. These are experts in planning, logistics, transportation, security, and engineering. They're going to be doing a few things. One, make sure that humanitarian aid is able to flow and surge into Gaza. They're going to monitor the ceasefire. What does that mean? That means U.S. troops, alongside what a separate senior administration official identified as troops from Egypt, Qatar, Turkey, and possibly the UAE. They're going to work with the UN. They're going to work with NGOs who are inside of Gaza to try and make sure what's happening in Gaza adheres to the rules of this phase one deal. And then eventually, those troops from those other countries will actually replace the IDF in Gaza and become the international security force inside of Gaza, trying to provide security, verify demilitarization, and create some kind of new civilian governance. But the big caveat, of course, is that all of that is in phase two. That's very far from now. But also, no country individually has actually pledged to send troops into Gaza yet, so it's all very much TBD.
And how did U.S. officials describe that plan as helping seal the deal for phase one?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So last night, those two senior administration officials told reporters on the call that President Trump basically personally guaranteed to Hamas that the war would not restart, and that they used, that he used, rather, this U.S. military presence in Israel as a way to guarantee that the U.S. would make sure Israel would not restart the war. These officials also said that the presence of Admiral Brad Cooper, that is the Central Command commander, the CENTCOM commander, in these talks, that helped Arab mediators convince Hamas the U.S. would ensure that Israel stuck to the ceasefire. And here's another moment that they said helped lead to the deal. That strike right there, that was Israel's failed attack in early September on senior Hamas political leaders in Doha. The senior administration official said it caused, quote, a lot of angst in the Arab world, and, quote, there was a sense it shouldn't happen. And so a few weeks later, this scene, President Trump pushed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the Oval Office to call Qatar's prime minister and apologize. Quote, that got us leverage, the administration official said. And so here we are, waiting for phase one. Officials I speak to say they are worried about the next few days. They're worried that Hamas does not fully control all of the fighters, and there could be an attack in Gaza or in Israel, and they're worried about how Israel would respond, let alone worried about that phase two concerns and what Netanyahu said about the war restarting if Hamas doesn't demilitarize. But bottom line, Jeff, certainly on both sides, Israelis and Palestinians tonight, hoping the ceasefire holds and this is the end of the war.
Nick Schifrin, grateful as always for your reporting this past week in particular. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
We start today's other headlines in Tennessee, where officials say at least 19 people are missing and feared dead after an explosion at a plant that handles military-grade explosives. The blast happened earlier today at Accurate Energetic Systems, about 60 miles southwest of Nashville. Aerial footage showed flames and smoke rising from the scene. Residents who live miles away said they felt their homes shake when the blast occurred. When asked by reporters how to characterize the scene, the county sheriff was at a loss for words.
Can I describe the building? There's nothing to describe. It's gone. It's, again, it's the most devastating scene that I've seen in my career.
Authorities say there's no further danger to locals, and as of this afternoon, the scene was under control. The cause of the blast is not yet known. In Memphis, National Guard troops were seen patrolling the city for the first time today. A small group was spotted near a popular shopping destination, escorted by police. It's not clear how many Guard members are on the ground and how many will be sent overall. Unlike in places like Chicago and Portland, the deployment was welcomed by state officials like Republican Governor Bill Lee. It's part of President Trump's broader push into cities that his administration says are overrun with crime. And while Memphis has dealt with high crime for years, the most recent data shows a decline in several categories, including murder. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology is rejecting a White House proposal to adopt the government's priorities on education in exchange for funding benefits. In a letter, MIT's president said she cannot support the agreement, adding that the premise of the document is inconsistent with our core belief that scientific funding should be based on scientific merit alone. MIT is the first of nine colleges and universities to reject the proposal, which asked the schools to make commitments on issues like admissions caps, tuition freezes, and free speech on campus, among others. Turning overseas, two back-to-back earthquakes shook the Philippines today, killing at least seven people. They struck just hours apart along the same fault line off the country's southeastern coast. The first 7.4 magnitude quake hit Friday morning local time. The second quake was just slightly weaker. Tsunami warnings set off mass evacuations in coastal areas, though they have since been lifted. The Philippines is still recovering from last month's 6.9 magnitude earthquake that killed more than 70 people and displaced thousands more. Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado won this year's Nobel Peace Prize for her efforts at moving her country from dictatorship to democracy.
Am I talking to Maria Corina Machado?
Yes, this is Maria Corina.
It shall be announced here at the Nobel Institute that you will be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for 2025.
Oh my God.
Machado said she was humbled and grateful when she was reached by phone earlier today. She's been in hiding since last year after she was barred from running against President Nicolas Maduro for the presidency. Machado spoke to the NewsHour's Nick Schifrin after last year's election and said Maduro would not and could not silence her.
Well, I'm accused every single day of a new crime. I wouldn't have enough lives or years to address all the accusations they have put on me. I don't know what else they think they can do, but they certainly would not stop us from doing what we should. We will never, never surrender.
The U.S. has recognized Machado's ally, Edmundo Gonzalez, as Venezuela's rightful president-elect. Today's prize comes as the Trump administration has stepped up military pressure on the Maduro regime, conducting targeted military strikes on alleged drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean. Mr. Trump himself had made the case that he should win the Peace Prize in the run-up to today's announcement. Meantime, President Trump is threatening to raise tariffs on China. After the closing bell this afternoon, he posted on social media that starting November 1st, the U.S. will impose a tariff of 100% on China over and above any tariff that they are currently paying. He said the tariffs are in response to new restrictions that China is placing on rare earth minerals. Earlier in the day, stocks tumbled on Wall Street after President Trump signaled the new tariffs were coming. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 900 points on the day. The NASDAQ plunged more than 800 points. The S&P 500 posted its worst day since April. And sister Jean Dolores Schmidt has died. She was known to basketball fans around the globe for her role as the chaplain and chief fan for the men's team at Loyola University Chicago. At the age of 98, Sister Jean became a viral sensation for her constant presence during the school's fairy tale run to the men's Final Four back in 2018. She would lead the team in pregame prayers and provide players with support in victory and solace in defeat. Sister Jean held numerous roles at Loyola over her 60 years with the school and only stepped down back in August. She was 106 years old. And John Lodge, bassist and singer-songwriter for the Moody Blues, has died. Lodge was behind some of the British rock band's best-known works. Born in Birmingham, he joined the group in 1966. They performed together for more than five decades until 2018, the same year they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. All told, the Moody Blues released 15 studio albums, and Lodge released another five on his own. Lodge's family said he died suddenly and unexpectedly, surrounded by his loved ones and the sounds of the Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly. John Lodge was 82 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, how one community has built a network of geothermal energy. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's headlines. And actors Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter on their Broadway adaptation of a classic.
This is the PBS NewsHour from the David M. Rubenstein Studio at WETA in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As the federal government shutdown heads into its second weekend, the Trump administration has started what it says are substantial layoffs of federal workers. The president and his team had suggested this would be coming, but it was Office of Management and Budget Director Russell Vogt who made it official on social media this afternoon, stating simply, the rifts have begun. For more on what agencies might be affected by this reduction in force, we turn to our congressional correspondent, Lisa Desjardins. Lisa, you have been working the phones all afternoon. Yes. What have you learned?
Our whole team has. Well, President Trump actually just spoke to reporters a few minutes ago, and he said the layoffs, there will be a lot of them, but that numbers will still be coming. We don't have the numbers yet. So there is a real question here about how widespread these substantial rifts or layoffs are, as we've been told by the Office of Management and Budget. Are they really large, or is it that the administration wants them to be perceived that way so that they can leverage and pressure Democrats, among others? One thing we do know a little bit about is where they are happening. From our calls and sourcing today, we can report that these eight agencies will be seeing these mass layoffs. This includes some large agencies like Department of Homeland Security, the Treasury, and Education. Many of these did experience large staffing cuts, either from the DOGE retirement plan or from previous layoffs. Now, again, we don't know how large they are. The IRS has confirmed to me that there are, in fact, mass layoffs happening there. Again, don't know how large. There is a union that has said they think perhaps 1,300 people may have been laid off at Treasury, but we need to see the notices. And one reason that's important is, when do these take effect? 30 days by law is the minimum notice that must be given for these reductions in force.
And as we said, there's a lot we don't know, but are there specific examples of agencies or programs that have been targeted for these cuts?
We do know of one where we can get specific. This is a sub-agency of the Department of Homeland Security. It's known as CISA. That stands for the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. They watch basically the digital world, the internet, protect Americans from threats from that area. Now, I know first of all, the agency is about 2,500 people for perspective. 127 of them are going to be laid off or have been laid off. So that's about 5% of the agency. But here's the thing. They are all within one subdivision, a subdivision that specializes in dealing with corporations and social media, the same subdivision that Republicans say took down political speech, and it is the one that was blocking disinformation dealing with Facebook. So that's a targeted agency that Republicans don't like. 70% of that group is being cut here. I bring this up because President Trump also just told reporters that, again, this will be Democratic-oriented cuts. So we have to watch. What does this mean agency to agency? How much of it is about policy?
Lisa Desjardins, our thanks to you as always.
You're welcome.
Well, keeping our focus on the shutdown, yesterday we heard from Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune. And today, for a Democratic view, I spoke earlier with House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries. Leader Jeffries, welcome back to the NewsHour.
Thanks for having me on.
When you were on this program 9 days ago, you said there'd been no communication from either the White House or Republican leaders in the House or the Senate about ending this shutdown. It doesn't appear that that's changed, has it?
It has not changed, unfortunately. This is day 10 of the Trump Republican shutdown. Clearly, they don't want to reopen the government. As Democrats, we've made clear, we'll sit down with anyone, anytime, any place to have a bipartisan negotiation about enacting a spending bill that makes life better for the American people, reopens the government, and addresses the Republican health care crisis. Unfortunately, House Republicans, who canceled votes last week, canceled votes this week, and have now canceled votes next week, remain on vacation, missing in action, and Donald Trump has shown no interest in actually trying to resolve this situation.
What do you make of these Republican proposals to partially reopen the government, funding select agencies while leaving other ones shuttered?
I think it's important for us to make sure that we actually pay our men and women in uniform in a manner consistent with what has been done in prior shutdowns. That should be priority number one at this moment, more than 1.3 million people who are on active duty and have been asked to work without pay because of the Republican refusal to address this issue. And so I think we need to take that step forward and then evaluate whatever other proposals come forward relative to reopening the government. But we have to reopen the government in a way that also addresses the Republican health care crisis and the Republicans' continued refusal to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits, which is going to have a devastating impact on premiums, copays, and deductibles for tens of millions of Americans all across the country.
As we speak this afternoon, the OMB director, Russ Vogt, tweeted moments ago, the rifts have begun, making good apparently on the threat of mass layoffs by the Trump administration. An OMB spokesperson says that the layoffs will be significant. Do you have a sense of which agencies would be affected, how many people would be affected? And beyond that, this is a clear power play by the administration to force the hand of Democrats. Does this play any role in your decision making?
Donald Trump and his corrupt administration have been engaging in mass firings and layoffs of federal employees since January 20th. They've been targeting hardworking federal employees, pressuring them, dismissing them without justification, and violating the law. So this is just a continuation of the chaos, the crisis, and the confusion that we've seen during the entirety of the Trump administration. We're going to continue to stay the course as Democrats. That's what House and Senate Democrats have done together to address the situation that Republicans have created. Largest cut to Medicaid in American history. Hospitals, nursing homes, and community-based health clinics closing all throughout America, particularly in rural parts of this country. The fact that Republicans refused to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits, resulting in dramatically increased health care premiums for tens of millions of Americans that will cost double, triple, or quadruple what they are currently paying. Some will face medical bankruptcy. Many others will be unable to get the insurance and the access to the doctors that they need. And on top of all of that, they're targeting the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control, in ways that are going to undermine the public health infrastructure in the United States of America. This has been an all-out Republican assault on the health care of the American people, which is why it needs to be decisively addressed right now, because it impacts everyone.
When you talk about Democrats and Republicans working together on health care, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, as you well know, no fan of Democrats, not typically aligned with Democrats, says she supports preserving the ACA subsidies, in large part because she says the insurance premiums of her adult children are set to skyrocket. Does that signal any real opening for bipartisan cooperation?
I think what it signals is a growing recognition amongst my Republican colleagues that we have a health care crisis. Unfortunately, it's a health care crisis that they've created, and it needs to be decisively addressed. House Republican leaders continue to bury their heads in the sand, unfortunately, and they're joined by Senate Republican leadership that continues to force vote after vote on their partisan Republican spending bill that Democrats aren't supporting, because that partisan Republican spending bill continues to gut the health care of everyday Americans. And that's not an acceptable situation in this country, the wealthiest country in the history of the world.
I want to ask you about the politics of all this, because just the other day, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, he said that Democrats have the momentum, and he said, quote, every day gets better for us. Republicans are seizing upon that, including the Senate Majority Leader John Thune, who was on this program last night, and they're accusing Democrats of politicizing the shutdown. Do you worry that a moment like that, a statement like that, undercuts what you see as Democrats having the moral high ground?
Well, House Democrats and Senate Democrats, led by Leader Schumer, are in this fight to make life better for the American people, to lower health care costs, to address the Republican health care crisis, to cancel the cuts, and to save the health care of the American people. That's the reason why we're in this fight.
For federal workers who risk missing a paycheck, for military families facing uncertainty, for everyday Americans who want to visit a national park, they are all wondering, when will this shutdown end? What would you tell them?
We need Donald Trump and Republicans to come to the negotiating table. We want to reopen the government. We want to reopen it now. We want to reach a bipartisan agreement in a way that spends taxpayer dollars that actually improve the quality of life of the American people, that addresses the cost of living crisis that we're confronting in this country. You know, Donald Trump and Republicans promised that costs would go down on day one, but costs aren't going down under Republican control of government here in Washington. Costs are going up. Inflation is going up. The Trump tariffs are making life more expensive for millions of Americans who are paying thousands of dollars in additional expense per year. And now we're on the brink of this massive increase in premiums, copays, and deductibles because of a Republican refusal to sit down and negotiate an extension around the Affordable Care Act tax credits. We stand by our hardworking federal employees. We will continue to support them. We stand by the American people, and we want to bring this to a close, but we need good faith partners on the other side of the aisle to sit down and negotiate a bipartisan path forward.
House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries, thanks again for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now the story of an unlikely partnership between a utility company and climate activists and how they work together to help one community switch its heating and cooling to a cleaner source. Science correspondent Miles O'Brien has the story, part of our Tipping Point coverage on energy and climate.
Retired schoolteacher Carol Canova has lived in this tidy little house in Framingham, Massachusetts for 30 years. From this humble perch, she has experienced firsthand a historic energy transition. She started with an oil-burning furnace, then switched to gas, and now heats and cools with an electric heat pump attached to a geothermal well.
I was told it would be even heat. I was told it would be efficient and so forth. But seeing is believing. I'd never been in a house that every place in the house was the same temperature.
Canova is part of a first-in-the-nation pilot by utility giant Eversource. It's a one-mile network of underground pipes connecting 36 homes and municipal buildings to a shared geothermal well. It's called Networked Geothermal, and if it works here, it could be a blueprint for utilities nationwide.
So I thought, oh, electricity is expensive. So I'm expecting it's going to be more expensive. What I find out is it's overall cheaper.
Heat pumps live up to their name. They move heat. In the summer, they pump heat out of your home. In the winter, they bring it in. How hard they have to work and how much electricity they use depends on the temperature difference between inside and outside. The greater the gap, the more energy they need. Shallow geothermal wells tap into the Earth's steady underground temperature, about 55 degrees year-round. Water with antifreeze circulates through buried pipes, absorbing or releasing heat at that consistent temperature. A heat pump paired with a geothermal well has less work to do and is far more efficient no matter the weather above. The catch? Drilling a geothermal well is very expensive. But none of the volunteers in this project paid a dime for either the well or the heat pump.
When Eversource offered it, I thought, you know what? This is like winning the lottery.
Everything else is buried and underground, except for the heat pumps.
Nikki Bruno is an Eversource VP.
So right outside this building is what we call the main bore field.
She showed me the pump house, which controls the entire system. It's the only visible sign of the geothermal network.
Those bores are 600 to 700 pipes that allow the water-based fluid to circulate and exchange energy with the underground.
Besides many homes like Carol's, heat pumps attached to the geothermal network are in use at a school administration building, a fire station, and a public housing development. It's an $18.6 million project that comes amid significant changes in regulations. Massachusetts and the other states in the Eversource territory have aggressive climate goals and mandates.
How do we start offering something different? How can we produce a decarbonized product for our customers while keeping, you know, safe, reliable, and I'll say as affordable as possible service to customers?
The idea was born of an unlikely partnership between utility executives and climate activists. Among them, Zainab Maghavi, the executive director of the nonprofit HEAT, the Home Energy Efficiency Team. It's a grassroots group that started out by banding together to insulate their homes. They were looking for a way to make a bigger dent.
We really became aware of kind of a rock and a hard place problem, where we have a gas system that actually we have pipes in the ground from President Lincoln's time.
Their focus on creaky, leaky gas pipes led them to a moment of insight and inspiration.
The ground, the bedrock, the water, all around us is thermal energy, which we can tap. And that's kind of an exciting awakening thing to realize. We could potentially build a utility street by street that was pipes filled with water, maintained and managed by the gas utility, who has become a thermal utility. This infrastructure would be, in a way, like the roots of our new energy system, right?
Even federal researchers are bullish. A study by the Oak Ridge National Laboratory found that mass adoption of geothermal heat pumps could reduce the demand for electricity by 13% in the next 25 years. But the idea isn't new. Let's go down to the boiler room. Here we go. You got people down here shoveling coal, right?
This is our living laboratory.
Cornell University engineering professor Jeff Tester built his home in Ithaca, New York, as a living lab of efficiency. Solar thermal, photovoltaics, and a heat pump that taps into a geothermal well buried in his backyard. He's been advocating for ways to tap the heat beneath our feet since the 1970s, when he helped pioneer a novel geothermal energy concept at the Los Alamos National Laboratory.
One method of extracting heat or mining heat from under the surface of the earth is to create a reservoir.
He looks back on those days with nostalgia.
They were very supportive of trying new things in those days. We weren't afraid to try something.
For about 25 years, Cornell has harnessed a natural thermal engine to keep its campus cool. A district chilling system taps 39-degree water from the depths of Cayuga Lake to cool more than 100 buildings. Now the university is looking to go deeper and warmer. Jeff Tester is the principal investigator on a groundbreaking project to introduce geothermal heating to the campus. In 2022, his team drilled a nearly 2-mile-deep test borehole to assess the available heat resources here.
I feel like I've been training all my life for the day when we actually would see this happen on a campus like Cornell.
But he's still waiting, looking for money to build a geothermal network of pipes filled with hot water to heat the campus. He says society places great value on fossil fuels and electricity.
But heat is not viewed that way in the same way. And I think we need a fairer system of what I refer to as an equivalent way to actually look at the benefits from clean heating versus clean electricity versus clean fuels. And we're not doing that right now. So we need a new value system for energy.
The Trump administration apparently does value geothermal. Energy Secretary Chris Wright consistently emphasizes it as a priority, making it the only renewable energy source currently in favor.
It's something we can agree on. It's the ground beneath our feet. It turns out we have common ground.
And it appears to be growing. Plans are now in place to double the size of the Framingham geothermal network starting next year. Common ground may be hard to find these days, but perhaps it's not far beneath the surface. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Framingham, Massachusetts.
With President Trump celebrating victories abroad and targeting political enemies here at home, there is much to discuss tonight with Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart of MSNBC. With a hello to you both.
Jeff.
So both Israel and Hamas have agreed to phase one of the peace plan. We see the negotiations there on the screen, and that was followed by today celebrations in Israel and also along the Gaza Strip. I want to start with your reaction to this real breakthrough. Jonathan.
Look, I'm going to say something that I have never said before and that this audience has never heard me say before. Kudos to the president. I think we are at this point because the president was single-mindedly focused on getting something, getting a deal done, getting the hostages out. The hard part comes after he leaves the region. After we get past phase one, assuming we get the 20, the Israeli hostages released, the 20 who are presumed alive, after the 2,000 Palestinians are released by Israel, once we get past that, there are so many questions that are still out there that leaves me skeptical that my kudos to the president will maintain. One, will they be able to get Hamas disarmed? Two, will there be a legitimate negotiating partner among the Palestinians for Israel and everyone to negotiate with, an international stabilization force for the area? And also the big thing, sort of Palestinian self-governance, or in other words, a two-state solution, something that Prime Minister Netanyahu has made clear he's not interested in. And if we're going to get through all these phases of this peace plan, the single-minded focus of the president that got us to this crucial point will be needed for the next 19 phases. And I just don't see how he does that.
And given the history of dashed hopes in the region, what gives you hope that this agreement can endure?
I got hope when Jonathan praised the president. So I had my fingers crossed. You know, he deserves a Nobel Prize. I thought you were going to go there. But, you know, it's impressive what Trump has did. First, he got together with the Saudis and the Qataris in New York during UN Week and came up with this 20-point plan. And then he understood how to deal with Netanyahu. And I should say, in fairness, the Trump administration, both the first term and the second term, has been better on the Middle East than the Obama and Biden administration. There's something about that region he sort of gets. And so the way to do with Biden, way to do with Netanyahu, is you show total support for Israel at the same time you're leaning on them. And so I think the Biden people, when they were always withdrawing and threatening and saying, don't do that, that made Israel feel insecure. And they had to negotiate from a position of security, and then they could bend. And so he got Bibi to go against his far-right colleagues who wanted to basically annex the Gaza. And there is, like, now a separate Gazan territory, and that's an important achievement. The Qataris are an important role. Why is this little country in the center of all this? Partly because they are part of those Gulf states who wanted to make the Middle East a modern place. And so I think they play a tremendously constructive role because they seem to talk to everybody. Will it work? I don't know, but there's no choice. There's no solution. Martin Indyk, who died about a year ago, had a piece in Foreign Affairs called The Strange Revival, I'm summarizing, of the two-state solution. Everybody wants to give up on the two-state solution. There is no alternative to the two-state solution. And so they're just going to have to stumble their way forward. Are they going to get there? Who knows? We've been covering the Middle East for a long time. They don't get there. But it looks a lot better than I thought it would look 6 months ago, a year ago, 5 years ago.
Yeah. Well, shifting our focus to domestic politics, this past week we saw former FBI Director James Comey arraigned. We saw New York Attorney General Letitia James indicted, both by the same Trump-appointed prosecutor. The former Trump National Security Advisor turned Trump critic John Bolton could be next, according to reports from MSNBC. And we talked about this last week when the focus was solely on Comey, but President Trump's campaign of retribution is expanding.
Yeah. Because this is what he told us he was going to do. The folks who have been indicted or expected to be indicted soon are on the list. People like Senator Adam Schiff of California, private citizen now, Miles Taylor. The president made it clear that he wants something done and he wants his Justice Department to do it. He's on the record as saying they are guilty of something. Pam. Go find it. Pam being the attorney general, Pam Bondi. So this is chilling because you now have a Justice Department that is supposed to at least nominally be separate and removed from the White House, taking orders from the president of the United States, who famously said, where's my Roy Cohn? Well, his Roy Cohn is named Pam Bondi.
David, there are supporters of the president who say that Letitia James ran on a campaign of going after Donald Trump, and that this is simply accountability coming full circle, that this is justified reciprocity, to which you would say what?
Well, that's how Donald Trump clearly thinks. He thinks they were politically motivated prosecutions. And I somewhat agree with him. I don't think Trump would have been brought up on those charges if he hadn't been Donald Trump. Nonetheless, what matters is the evidence. And Letitia James, she's accused of doing mortgage fraud that would have produced a benefit over the lifetime of the loan of $18,000. Now, you think about the numbers Donald Trump inflated his property values. They were not $18,000. They were times 100 million of that. And so the evidence against Comey is slight. The case against James is, no one would have prosecuted. We know that because other prosecutors refused to do it.
Right.
This is clearly a revenge prosecution. Donald Trump makes it hard on us pundits because he's so blatant, there's nothing interesting to say.
It is kind of all out there in the open.
Right, it's out there.
Well, today marks the 10th day of the government shutdown, as we heard from the House Democratic leader. There have still been no substantive talks among the different parties. October 15th, I have that day circled on my calendar because that's the day that if the government is still shut down, members of the military, if things stay the way they are, who have been deemed essential. They've been on the job. They will not get a paycheck. I mean, what do you make of all this at this point?
You know why there aren't talks? Because the Republicans are not in town. The Speaker of the House has kept the House out of session now for 19 or 20 days and has already said that they're not coming back next week. You would think that the House Speaker being on C-SPAN and taking that very emotional call on the Republican line, a woman saying, a military wife, talking about the need for, like, the not only health care, but for the check, for the paycheck, and saying, get, where are you guys? Get back to work. And he pivoted and blamed the Democrats. If they want to change, if they want to change the calculus of this conversation, they being Republicans, they should come back to town. Because if everyone's in town, then there's no excuse. Democrats will be in town in the House, will be in town next week. Why not come back to town and say, you want to talk? Let's talk.
When even Marjorie Taylor Greene is calling out her own party and saying we need a fix for the Obamacare subsidies, what does that say about the internal dynamics within the GOP?
Not much, I don't think. Marjorie Taylor Greene is out there and wherever she is. I think the Republicans, like the Democrats, frankly, are pretty unified. And the weird thing about that is usually when you cover a shutdown, somebody's feeling the heat. Nobody's feeling the heat yet.
Why is that?
I think of two things. One, the American people haven't yet felt it. Maybe if you air travel, you begin to feel that. When the military doesn't get paid, they feel it. But right now, they're not feeling it. I was in Colorado this week, and believe me, nobody was raising this with me. Nobody talked about it. That may change. Second, the American people have become so jaded and disgusted that they're just like, oh, whatever. And so if you look at the polling, at the beginning, it looked like they were more blaming Trump. But now, if you look at do you approve of the way Democrats in House and Republicans in Congress, how are they handling it? It's like both get a 28 positive rating, so a low rating on both parties. But it's not really feeling the heat on either of these people. The second thing that I think it's quite easy to cut a deal if the shutdown is really what Hakeem Jeffries said it was, which was about health care premiums. And it is partly about that. And Democrats, of course, are smart to talk that way because it's an issue that polls great for them. But I don't think it's only about that. For a lot of Democrats, it's also about Trump's authoritarianism. It's Trump's willingness to dishonor and disrespect Congress and not spend the money they have appropriated. And that's a much deeper issue that's much harder to resolve because Donald Trump is not doing that. And then the Republicans are also a little divided. Russell Vought did the riffs are starting today. There are a lot of congressional Republicans that don't like that.
Yeah.
And so there are these tensions within both parties, but so far their feet is not to the fire. But that may come in a couple weeks.
Well, as the shutdown drags on and more layoff notices keep landing, should Democrats hold the line?
Yeah. Yeah, because I actually do think that they are pushing on health care because it's something that they care about. And, I mean, I take your point that the American people aren't feeling it writ large. But when you have a Republican calling on the Republican line on C-SPAN to chastise the Republican House Speaker of the Republican House Speaker, and you've got the poster child for MAGA, who is also saying, you know, this premiums thing is an issue. To me, that says that the ground is shifting. But I agree with David in this. While healthcare is the overarching sort of popular issue because it's something that will affect the American people directly, rescissions has been my hobby horse. Because why would and should Democrats trust any negotiation that they get into with Republicans and that is signed by the president if they know that once before the ink is dry, Russell Vought and the president will snatch back the money, snatch back the authority?
Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, our thanks to you both.
Thank you.
It's a theater classic that continues to be taken on by top actors and resonates with audiences. Waiting for Godot, yes, that's how it's pronounced, mixes high despair and low comedy to raise big questions about, well, the meaning of life. And now two actors, great friends themselves, are doing their waiting on Broadway. Senior arts correspondent Jeffrey Brown gets a look for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Who am I to tell my private nightmares to if I can't tell them to you?
Let them remain private. You know I can't bear that.
There are times when I wonder if it wouldn't be better for us to part.
You wouldn't go far.
Two men, Estragon called Gogo and Vladimir or Didi, fearing, laughing, talking, waiting for someone they don't know. The two men playing them, Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter. And why are they here?
Yeah, but what did I know? I just answered the universe who said you should do Waiting for Godot with Alex. And I was like, you're right. Okay, I'll ask him.
And he said,
absolutely, yeah, but it's a mountain. Let's go climb the mountain.
That mountain waiting for Godot, or Godot as they've chosen to pronounce it in this production, by Nobel Prize-winning Irish playwright Samuel Beckett. Written and first performed in the 1950s, it's still raising deep issues of human existence through a mix of pain and suffering along with broad comedy.
Which of you smells so bad?
He has stinking breath and I have stinking feet.
I must go.
Keanu Reeves, of course, is a mega movie star, best known for his roles in The Matrix and John Wick series. This is his Broadway debut. Alex Winter, a Broadway and film veteran, is best known in recent years as a director of documentaries, including one on rock star Frank Zappa.
Excellent!
The two are forever linked through their roles starting in their 20s in the Bill and Ted sci-fi comedy films that began in 1989, about two rather clueless dudes who get their history lessons through time travel. They've been close friends ever since, the kind who often finish each other's sentences on and off stage. And when we met recently at Broadway's famed Sardi's restaurant, Reeves, now 61, and Winter, 60, said taking on Waiting for Godot together was a must.
Was that because it made it more fun, or because it got you past the fear of doing it, or?
For me, it just started with the fun. This seems like a really good idea, yeah.
Yeah, and also that there it is a play about two old friends who are interested in interrogating the questions of life, which is very much the two of us. So
it is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, offstage.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like going back to you know. Look, we're goofballs and lead normal lives as well. But like I remember certain nights, even on Bill and Ted 1, it would be like 2 o'clock in the morning. We'd be sitting on the hood of my car and like in a strip mall in Phoenix, like debating existence. You know? So, like, in some ways, nothing has changed.
Look at me. Will you look at me? What a day.
Who beat you? Tell me.
Another day done with.
Not yet.
For me, it's over and done with, no matter what happens.
Are Gogo and Didi refugees from war or some environmental catastrophe? Figures myself, from outside of time? And who is this Godot?
Becky was cheeky, but I think he liked the fact that people debated these things. I think he was cheeky. He would say, oh, it's not God necessarily, but maybe it is. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, come on.
Come on, like, come on. If Samuel was here,
yeah.
I'd be like, come on.
Yeah.
You'd say, come on, Godot.
Of course, I mean, God is in Godot. Of yeah. course, of yeah. course, of course.
Moron, vermin, abortion, morpion, sewer rat, curate, cretin, critic!
The play has been done by certified funny men such as Steve Martin and Robin Williams, and amid boarded-up, flooded homes in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. This production, led by acclaimed British director Jamie Lloyd, takes a stripped-down story and strips it further to a bare, large tunnel or cone with no props at all. That, says Reeves, forced him to think and act in a new way.
It's even like the way I talked about the play early days. We could have mud, and why don't we have water? And how about if we do this, and I'll come out through the stage? And then Jamie Lloyd and Sutra Gilmore, the production designer, went, here's the set. Yeah. And all of those ideas, like in a mandala, just was like, that's get over that.
Did you find that freeing, though, too, to not have the props?
Oh, it's freeing, but also illuminating. I think that our production is actually illuminating the themes of the play and what it's asking and talking about. To have a literal tree that doesn't look like a tree, you're doing the same thing. You're asking the audience to pretend that It's got lots of leaves, mm-hmm. and it's like the spring, or mm-hmm. then there's a literal tree, and then I'm saying I see nothing. So they almost become more alive.
Yeah.
And to the conceit, it's more accurate.
It is, yeah. Every night you find something else. We'll come off stage even between Act 1 and Act 2, and he'll say or I'll say, that, like, oh, wow, right, that.
When still you're doing that every between
night.
Acts?
Every yeah. night. Every night there's something. It's just a play of limitless ideas and depth and possibility.
Do you see anything coming?
What?
Do you see anything coming?
No!
Nor I.
Does it feel that way on stage, too, where you're saying, oh, I'm with Alex?
Oh, yeah. I get to, I mean, so much of the night or the day, the performance, I'm just literally, like, looking at you.
Yeah, we do a fair
go
amount of that.
Go through your contortions. Poor Vladimir.
Poor Vladimir.
Trying to figure it out.
I know, and failing miserably.
And how does the play land today in a time of deep cultural and political divisions? Alex Winter had thought much about that, while Keanu Reeves offered lines from the play.
And we're certainly driving into it with the way we're doing it, is about looking past those divisions to this sort of human condition as a uniform issue that everyone faces. And this idea that we are all in this struggle together.
And all mankind is us.
Yeah, for this moment of time.
This moment of time.
Whether we like it or not. So let's do something. That's a pretty great thing to say right now. You know.
To help someone.
Yeah. Yeah.
We help him.
Yeah.
We help him.
Yeah.
Let us help him. We
yeah.
help him.
Yeah.
Yes, let's go.
Yeah.
Is it ultimately a hopeless or hopeful play?
Hopeful.
Yeah.
You're going with hopeful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they say, let's go. Well, shall we go? Yes, let's go.
But then they don't move.
But they're together.
But they're still said, let's go.
Yeah.
They're still doing it.
Yeah, they're together. I think that.
Another day.
Yeah, it lands on this idea that all we may have is each other, but that is enough to continue on. But everything else is up for grabs. Mm-hmm.
Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter, Gogo and Didi, are waiting for Godot into early January.
Finish your phrase, I tell you.
Finish your own.
Moron. That's the idea. Let's abuse each other.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown
moron.
On Broadway.
Vermin. Abortion.
Online, you can see more from Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter, including their mutual love of Dr. Seuss and their favorite plays. That's on our YouTube page. And be sure to watch Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight on PBS. The panel looks at why President Trump was able to broker the Israel-Hamas peace deal when others failed and considers whether the ceasefire will hold. And watch PBS News Weekend tomorrow. Best-selling author Mitch Albom discusses his latest book, his writing process, and his philosophy on giving back. And that is the NewsHour for tonight and this week. I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thanks for spending part of your evening with us, and have a great weekend.